From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The U.S. and its allies have bombed missile sites in Iraq. The Gulf War began 2 years ago this week. After the war, a Middle East peace initiative resulted in peace talks between Israel, Palestinians, and Arab countries. On today's Fresh Air, we get reactions to the bombing in Iraq and to the latest developments in and disruptions of the Middle East peace process. We'll talk with Palestinian historian Waleed Khalidi, a senior fellow at Harvard and a former member of the Jordanian-Palestinian delegation to the talks. And from Israel, we'll speak with Zev Chafetz, associate editor of the magazine Jerusalem Report. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At a news conference at his headquarters at Florida's MacDill Air Force Base, the U.S. Central Command chief says the results of today's Allied attack on targets in southern Iraq are not expected until later tonight. He said pilots involved in the mission indicate it was successful. Scott Horsley has more from Tampa.
Marine General Joseph Hoare says more than 100 aircraft from the U.S., France, and Great Britain took part in today's raid on surface-to-air missile sites in southern Iraq. All of those aircraft have now returned safely to their bases on the Arabian Peninsula and aboard the USS Kitty Hawk. The planes took photographs during the half-hour mission. Hoare expects to see those photos late tonight and know how many of the targets were hit.
Based on pilot reports, based on what we know to be true, we believe that it has been successful. That's cautiously optimistic, I would say.
Hoare says he doesn't know yet if any additional airstrikes are in the offing. A battalion of armored cavalry troops will be going to Kuwait to take part in exercises next week. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Horsley in Tampa.
President-elect Clinton's choice for Secretary of State said today that the incoming administration will keep up the pressure on Iraq while taking a tougher stance against Serbian aggression in Bosnia. At his confirmation hearing today, Warren Christopher said that Clinton will insist that Baghdad comply unconditionally with United Nations resolutions. A UN relief agency is disputing allegations it appeases Serbian forces in Bosnia by giving them almost a quarter of humanitarian aid supplies airlifted into the country. Today's New York Times cites an internal report commissioned by the State Department saying UN officials let Bosnian Serb forces determine what aid is provided, where, and to whom. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Zagreb.
As reported by the Times, a U.S. government relief expert hired to investigate the aid operation concluded UN officials allow Bosnian Serb forces to inspect aid deliveries, to approve the ethnic composition of UN truck drivers, and to dictate the routes relief convoys are to follow. 23% of airlifted aid is simply turned over to the Serb forces, according to the State Department report. A UN spokesman here today acknowledged aid officials must on occasion yield to Serb militiamen on the ground as the price of working in a war zone, but he denied there's a policy of appeasement. Bosnian Serbs, he said, are in fact entitled to about 19% of the airlifted aid. The problem is they often take more than their share. A UN official in Sarajevo reported that Serb forces outside the city just today confiscated almost half of a 100-ton shipment of firewood on its way to town. I'm Tom Jelton in Zagreb.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about a point to close at 3,263. This is NPR. Former East German leader Erich Honecker left Germany today to join his family in Chile. Honecker was freed by German courts, which decided not to prosecute him on manslaughter and embezzlement charges after learning that he's about to die from liver cancer. The 80-year-old communist leader was allowed to travel to Chile because he'd provided refuge for Chilean leftists after a right-wing coup in 1973. President Bush awarded his predecessor, Ronald Reagan, the Presidential Medal of Freedom today in the East Room of the White House. Mr. Bush called the former president a true American hero. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
It was perhaps the last time these two presidents will stand together at the White House. As the band played Hail to the Chief, the sound of carpenters building the inaugural platform outside was audible. The crowd of former Reagan staff and Bush cabinet members was teary-eyed as the president honored his former boss.
Some men reflect their times. Ronald Reagan changed his times. And nowhere was that more true than abroad, where he championed the Holy Grail of liberty. Mr. President, you helped make ours not only a safer, but far better world in which to live.
This is not the end of an era, Mr. Reagan said. The task of the peacemaker is never complete. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Aerial surveys in the Shetland Islands say that violent weather has dispersed much of the oil spilled from the wrecked tanker Brayer. After a week of heavy seas and high winds, the Brayer broke into three pieces yesterday and spilled the last of its 25 million gallons of crude oil. A British pollution expert said that today's survey showed that at least 90% of the oil around the tanker last night has now been dispersed. Even though most visual signs of the oil are now gone, environmentalists say the impact on the island's bird and marine life could be huge. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The U.S., Britain, and France bombed Iraqi missile sites today in response to Iraq's violations of U.N. demands. We have two reactions to the airstrike and a discussion of the latest developments in the Middle East peace process. Later on the show, Zev Chaffetz will join us from Jerusalem. He's the associate editor of the Jerusalem Report. First, we'll hear from Walid Khalidi, former member of the Jordanian-Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Khalidi is a senior research fellow at Harvard's Center for Middle Eastern Studies and author of the new collection of essays, Palestine Reborn. Khalidi was born in Jerusalem in 1925 and left in 1948 after the creation of Israel. We spoke earlier today. He told me he would oppose bombing civilian areas of Iraq, but bombing military sites is a different matter.
Definitely some signal must be sent to Saddam Hussein that he cannot just go on behaving in the way he is behaving. And I think the actions that he has taken on the Kuwaiti frontier warrant a military reprisal against military targets to get home the message that these actions must cease.
What do you think Saddam Hussein is trying to do?
I think there are probably two issues, or maybe three. One is, remember, this is the anniversary. The fighting, I think, began on the 14th or 15th of January, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. So
I think there is this desire to somehow project the image of my head is bloody but unbowed. 2 years later, I'm still there, and this is a kind of appropriate gesture from his point of view. On the anniversary. That's one aspect. I think the other aspect is teasing President Bush and knowing that he has very little time in the remaining days of his administration to carry on the whatever operations he starts beyond, as Saddam sees it, beyond Inauguration Day. Of course, he may be miscalculating here, in that he may not appreciate enough that President Clinton could carry on the policy initiated by President Bush, even though this policy may have been initiated in the last remaining days of the administration.
Well, what kind of support does Saddam Hussein have left in the Arab world?
I would say that Saddam does have support, not so much because of the any approval per se of what he did to Kuwait, but rather in because of the feeling that he is defying the Western powers who are seen by mass opinion, grassroots opinion, as the heirs of the old colonial and imperial powers. I think that is basically one of the main sources of his appeal to grassroots feelings. Another is the feeling that he is against a particular socioeconomic status quo, which militates against the have-nots in the Arab world. And yet even those who support him feel that what he did to Kuwait was unacceptable, intolerable, and indeed against the very principles of Arab chivalry, Arab solidarity, and the basic principles of Islamic inter-country, international relations.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Waleed Khalidi, and he is a senior research fellow at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies, a former member of the Jordanian-Palestinian delegations in the Middle East Peace Talks, and author of a new collection of essays called Palestine Reborn. I'd like your reaction to Israel's deportation of the over 400 people who they described as Islamic militant fundamentalists.
Well, this is practice of collective punishment, which it follows a particular pattern historically. The Palestinians see themselves as having been expelled from their, as they see it, their country in two major waves. The first wave was in 1948, and the second wave was in 1967. The issue of deportation touches a very, very raw nerve. It arouses primeval feelings of fear and insecurity. And that is why I think the stand of the Palestinians on this issue is as clear as it is.
You support Middle East peace talks. You support a two-state solution, a Palestinian state and an Israeli state. The fundamentalist movement within the Palestinians opposes the peace talks and opposes the existence of Israel. So I would think you might be disturbed by the growing strength of the fundamentalist movement within the Palestinian movement.
The way to tackle the fundamentalist movement is not by making martyrs of them, is not by throwing 415 of their of middle-class professional people who are non-activist, who have not gone through a due process judgment and justice, and to throw them into a no man's land, and have them kind of symbolize in this limbo, between two nations, between two peoples, the Lebanese and the Israelis, the statelessness and the homelessness of the Palestinians for all the world to see. If you do this, then what you are doing is strengthening the hand of the fundamentalists and increasing their appeal. The way to tackle the fundamentalist movement is to get on with the peace negotiations and to match one's words with deeds.
In the meantime, while the process is going on, what do you think the Israelis should do about a growing movement that wants to eradicate the state of Israel?
Well, I mean, what the Israelis should do is, what the Israeli government should do, is not to make martyrs of the fundamentalists. Why is there a fundamentalist movement? Because the occupation has lasted since 1967, because there does not seem to be any end of the colonization of the West Bank or of the Gaza Strip. Why does fundamentalism have a greater appeal in the Gaza Strip? Because the Gaza Strip is a black hole of Calcutta. It's an extraordinarily scandalous situation in which 750,000 people are squeezed between the Mediterranean and Israel within an area that does not extend beyond 5 miles across, while their own lands have already been seized and taken and are being populated by Israeli immigrants. I mean, it is a situation which inevitably produces this kind of reaction unless some attempt at meeting the Palestinian grievances is made, a serious attempt.
How long were you a member of the Jordanian-Palestinian delegation?
Well, I attended the Madrid conference, and then I attended the first two rounds of the negotiations at the State Department in Washington. And But I joined them, I think, about maybe 6 weeks before the Madrid conference.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, I was with them for about maybe 5 to 6 months.
Did you want to leave?
Oh, very much so, yes.
What? Why?
Well, frankly, I did not think the Israelis were serious. Not in whether they're not serious, but I thought they were definitely stalling. Absolutely no doubt about that.
What were the signals that you perceived?
Well, the refusal to discuss any matter of substance, the whole attitude, the overweening, patronizing, overbearing, indeed almost supercilious attitude, the debunking of every demand or statement made on the our side, and I felt that it was just a waste of time.
Do you still feel that way? Do you feel that way about the direction the peace talks took after you left?
Well, I feel that Rabin's image in the West, of course, is much rosier than that of Shamir. But in the last analysis, it's a question of not of words, but of deeds. I'm not personally convinced that Rabin has the political strength or the political vision or the political will or the noblesse oblige that, for example, characterized de Gaulle. Rabin is no de Gaulle.
What are your hopes or expectations about the Clinton administration? Are you what do you think he will do? What would you like him to do on the Middle East?
Well, first of all, obviously it's much too early to. The man hasn't even assumed office yet.
Yes.
To the extent that one can infer what the policy is from electoral promises, the outlook is grim for the Arab side and the Palestinians. I'm filled with great foreboding with regard to Clinton's policies on the Palestine problem.
Why?
Because of the electoral promises, because of statements made that are, I mean, long political statements, foreign policy statements, that indicates a tilt so massive on the Israeli side that I see very little hope.
What promises are you referring to?
Well, it is not. Well, there are certain specific things with regard to Jerusalem. There are certain things with regard to colonization, the settlement. For example, Clinton was against the policy of pressuring Shamir on settlements. He was against the linkage between the granting of the 10 billion housing loans, guarantees, and the cessation of colonization, settlement activity. He was against this. He thought even Shamir should not be pressured.
My guest is Palestinian historian Waleed Khalidi. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Waleed Khalidi, and he is a senior research fellow at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies, a former member of the Jordanian-Palestinian delegation to the Middle East Peace Talks, and author of the new collection of essays, Palestine Reborn. You support a two-state solution in the Middle East, an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. What brought you to that conclusion? Was there a point in your life where you didn't support that?
Oh, yes, much so. I was opposed to the concept of partition of Palestine in 1947. I continued to oppose this concept for two decades, maybe even well into the 60s. My attitude was based on a moral dimension, on a moral a premise, that the process by which Israel was established was at the expense of the indigenous population, that it lacked justice and morality, and that therefore I was not going to support it.
Now, what changed your mind about it?
What changed my mind is the feeling that in this particular issue, the United States was a party to the conflict that was fundamentally and to some extent almost unconditionally on the Israeli side, and that therefore there was no military option available. I reached this conclusion long before the Soviet Union dropped out of the equation, and that the idea of waging war against the United States was impracticable and mad, and therefore the need was to try and reach some kind of modus vivendi with the Israelis, and that this modus vivendi could best be approached via the concept of a two-state solution.
So your support of partition as a solution and your willingness to recognize the state of Israel has more to do with practical considerations than respect for Israel's right to exist.
My considerations are based on the need to put a ceiling to suffering of both peoples, to start give people on both sides a new opportunity, an opportunity for a new phase in their relations, a new and different phase, qualitatively different. It is not based upon my feeling that the process by which Zionism wrested Palestine from its indigenous population was a moral one. I do not think that was moral, but I do not think that that should stand in the way of a pragmatic approach.
You use the expression that you wanted to end the suffering on both sides.
Yes.
Now, I think there's people on each side who only see the suffering of their own side. Was there a point where you started to comprehend something of the suffering of the other side, of the Jews in Israel?
Well, I mean, everybody, I mean, I'm a historian, and I'm not unfamiliar with the history of the Jews, not only before the 20th century, but also, of course, with the Holocaust. But I also believe that the suffering that you go through does not justify your infliction of suffering on the others. In other words, I do not think the Jewish suffering justifies the infliction of suffering on the Palestinians. One of the premises of Zionism is that because of Jewish suffering historically and in the Holocaust, therefore they are virtually entitled to do more or less anything that that they are able to with regard to the Palestinians. I cannot accept this. At the same time, I realize that the people who have come to Palestine and to Israel from various Jewish communities all over the world are three-dimensional human beings like myself who have not come of their own free will, but were victims of compulsion and circumstances beyond their control, and that the attempt to resort to a military solution of this conflict is bound to have catastrophic dimensions for both sides, and that therefore there must be a very serious pursuit of the pragmatic solution of partition.
You're a historian. Did becoming a historian have anything to do with trying to understand Palestinian history?
Yes, of course. The problem is that is how not to allow the history to preempt the future, the past to preempt the future. And yet, the question and challenge is, how can you chart for the future without taking into account what happened in the past? And one of the problems, I think, that face us today, face people who look upon the scene from, shall we say, the United States, is that there is an enormous difference in their knowledge of the history of one side as opposed to the history of the other. Americans, Western people in general, know about the Jewish history. They know next to nothing about Arab history or Muslim history. The fact is that Arabs have been in Palestine for more than 1,000 years and continuously. And some families, indeed, in Jerusalem itself, trace their descent generation after generation for that period of time, for 1,000 years. My family, for example. And that's not unique. I mean, there are many others. But there is no knowledge of this in the outside world, I mean, in the Western world. Jewish history is brought up, is obviously connected with the Old Testament, which is very much part of Western Christian civilization. The Quran is not. So there is a kind of asymmetry in the West's knowledge of the history of each side, which I think affects, the assessment of the, as it were, the merits of the case of each side, and also the parameters of a possible honorable solution, a peaceful solution, and which has to have some roots in justice. It cannot be based on absolute justice. You cannot pursue absolute justice. You can pursue pragmatic justice. And I think that it is possible to... but pragmatic justice takes into account both the suffering of each side, the history of each side, and the realities of the balance of power. Absolute justice would say Israel is immoral, but then where do you go from there? Pragmatic justice says the way in which Israel was established is immoral, but we have to put an end to suffering. We have to get to give people on both sides a chance. This is where the historians, I think, tasks comes in an attempt to strike a balance between the history of the conflict and the requirements, minimal at least, requirements for a solution that is at least pragmatically just.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking me.
Waleed Khalidi is a senior research fellow at Harvard's Center for Middle Eastern Studies. He has a new collection of essays called Palestine Reborn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On the second part of our show, an Israeli perspective on the peace process, we'll talk with Zev Chaifetz, associate editor of the Jerusalem Report.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Israel's deportation of militant Islamic fundamentalists has been protested by Palestinians and leaders of Arab countries. Coming up, an Israeli response to those criticisms. We'll talk with Zev Chaifetz, associate editor of the magazine Jerusalem Report. We'll also get his response to the bombing of Iraqi missile sites. And TV critic David Bianculli is in a nostalgic mood. He's been watching reruns of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour on cable's E! Entertainment Network. He has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Dozens of U.S.-led warplanes took part in a bombing mission over southern Iraq today because officials say that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has been in violation of terms halting the Persian Gulf War. A White House spokesman said the mission had been slated for yesterday but was postponed because of bad weather. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that all U.S. planes returned to their bases. According to U.S. officials, the air attack was limited, confined to the southern part of Iraq, and directed at missile batteries and supporting equipment there. 2 weeks ago, an Iraqi airplane was shot down over a no-fly zone. Shortly after today's Allied attack began, Iraq's ambassador to the U.N. said that Baghdad was ready to comply with U.N. Security Council resolutions. At the U.N., NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Iraqi Ambassador Nizar Hamdoun was summoned to the UN this afternoon. There he met with U.S., British, and French officials who reportedly told him Iraq must immediately comply with council demands or they suggested it would face further attacks. Earlier in the day, Hamdoun told reporters Iraq wanted to resolve the crisis.
I feel it's really sad that people are resorting to military actions rather than to try to resolve the issues peacefully, which Iraq has indicated its willingness to do.
In answer to a question, Hamdoun said Iraq was willing to comply with at least two of the council's demands. He said it would stop its border incursions against Kuwait and would allow UN inspectors to fly their own planes inside the country. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In the Middle East, initial Arab reaction to today's Allied airstrike against Iraq has been mixed. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Damascus for talks with Syrian President Hafez Assad expressed sorrow and regret that the situation had escalated to the point of force. But Mubarak says Iraqi President Saddam Hussein bears much responsibility for the Allied strike because he ignored appeals to stop actions condemned by the United Nations. Jordan, however, is criticizing the attack, saying the region has suffered enough from wars and tragedy. Jordan's information minister, Mahmoud El-Sharif, calls it ironic that Iraq should be singled out for punishment when, in his words, the violation of UN Security Council resolutions is happening everywhere. Egypt joined the U.S.-led alliance that evicted Iraq from Kuwait, but Jordan was among Arab states sympathetic to Baghdad during the Gulf crisis. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
Astronauts on board the space shuttle Endeavour have deployed a communication satellite some 6 hours after launch. Liftoff came this morning for the 6-day mission involving 5 astronauts. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 1 point to close at 3,263.56 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, very little fighting was reported overnight. However, according to ham radio reports, more than 50 children died in one town, isolated by Serbian forces for 9 months. U.S. officials have said several hundred thousand people could die this winter from starvation and exposure. Land convoys have been unable to get to certain isolated places because of landmines and snipers. UN diplomats have called on supporters of Western military intervention to wait for the outcome of Geneva peace talks. Bosnian-Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic left Geneva today hoping to sell a peace plan to the self-styled Parliament of Bosnia. If approved, it could lead to the end of the 9-month-old Bosnian conflict. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Geneva.
Karadzic appeared confident this morning, one day after he stunned the peace talks with his sudden conditional acceptance of a constitutional blueprint for Bosnia. Karadzic said he'll submit the plan to the Bosnian Serb Assembly, which is not internationally recognized and which is composed of extreme nationalists, many of whom adamantly want to create an independent Serbian state within Bosnia. Karadzic said today he's aware it won't be easy to get their approval.
They are going to reconsider it into fights, but I do hope I'll get majority.
Karadzic, who was pressured into accepting the plan by Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, said he may still need Milosevic's help to sell the peace to Bosnian Serbs. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
In Washington, by a 5-4 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that federal judges cannot stop protesters who try to block women from gaining entry to abortion clinics. This ruling is a victory for anti-abortion protesters and means that medical clinics will have to turn to state courts now for help. The ruling does not affect a woman's right to have an abortion. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. On today's program, we're looking at the latest developments in the Middle East peace process and getting reactions to the bombing of Iraqi missile sites. In the first part of our show, we spoke with Palestinian historian Waleed Khalidi. For a different perspective, we called Zev Shafitz in Jerusalem. He's the associate editor of the Jerusalem Report and was the head of the government press office under Menachem Begin. When we spoke earlier today, I asked him if he thought bombing Iraq was the right thing to do.
Getting rid of Saddam Hussein is doing the right thing, and that was what the allies should have done 2 years ago. It would have saved everybody, and not least the Iraqi people, the nightmare of the last 2 years with Saddam Hussein. And if what happens now is simply another bombing activity which destroys some more Iraqi hardware, it still won't do the job. Evidently, this guy is not learning the lesson that Bush and his colleagues think that they're teaching. And so, while I'm all in favor of bombing Iraq, I'm much more in favor of some kind of a concerted action, whether it's military or covert or even diplomatic, if it could work, which would remove the source of the problem and the reason that Iraq needs to be bombed, namely the regime of Saddam Hussein.
Does Iraq still feel like a threat to Israel?
Well, you know, I suppose that logically it doesn't, because we know that most of the ballistic missiles have been either destroyed or removed, and we know that Iraq is much weaker strategically than it was 2 years ago. But I'm sitting here talking to you from Jerusalem, and I am filled, as I'm sure most Israelis or many Israelis are, with many of the same emotions that we had 2 years ago when he was shooting Scuds at us. It brings back, it's very evocative, it brings back the stress and the concern and the looks on the faces of our children as we put the gas masks on them. And so no matter how rationally we can explain to ourselves and reassure ourselves that this is probably not going to result in a repeated series of attacks by Iraqi missiles on our cities, there's still a certain degree of anxiety which is attached to this entire thing.
Are you preparing for the possibility of attack against Israel?
Well, we all have gas masks. I have friends who've arrived in the last 2 years who didn't have a gas mask, who went out and got a new one today. There are ads in the Israeli papers for secure rooms, chemical warfare-proof rooms that can be installed and so forth. To that extent, yeah, I mean, people here are prepared, and they're also, after what happened 2 years ago, in a sense, psychologically prepared. What already has happened, evidently, and certainly could happen again. Whether it will or not, the official Israeli assessment at the moment is that there's a very low probability. And the country is not on a war footing, and there haven't been the kinds of warnings public announcements and so forth, which preceded the war 2 years ago. But people are, let's say, at least in the back of their minds, contemplating the prospect of some kind of an attack from Iraq.
I want to ask you about a few things that have been going on in Israel and the Middle East. Let's start with the recent deportations of the over 400 Palestinian Islamic fundamentalists, the militant fundamentalists. Do you think that the deportations have been backfiring against Israel? Do you think that the deportees have become martyrs and that they are furthering the cause of militant fundamentalism?
Well, I have no doubt that the very prominent, and I must say to a large extent sympathetic, Western coverage of the deportees has been a public relations black eye for Israel. There's no doubt about it. And in that sense, it's boomeranged. But it wasn't done primarily as a public relations exercise in any event. It was done mostly to both weaken the fundamentalist extremists on the ground, that is to say in the West Bank and Gaza, and also to send a message to the rest of the Palestinians, many of whom are sympathetic toward the fundamentalist point of view, but a majority of whom are not, that Israel will not sit by idly and watch a group whose ideology is the mass murder of Jews and whose practice is the individual murder of Jews and the collective murdering of the peace process, that we won't allow that group to go about its business as if it were the Kiwanis Club or the Elks or some other neutral or beneficent organization. It's not. It's a collection of truly demented religious lunatics and very violent ones. And so to that extent, in my opinion, it may have been a bad thing for Israel's public image, but I think it's probably been a good thing for the peace process.
Do you feel Israel had no choice but to deport them?
Well, it has. Israel always has choices, but the choices are less good than what we did. Israel could, for example, have sentenced them to death, which is, for example, what the Egyptians have been doing or what the Algerians have been doing. Israel could have expelled them forever, but in point of fact, it's expelled them only for between 9 months and 2 years. There are various ways of cracking down. This one, I think, appealed to the Rabin government because while it was an extremely clear message and an extremely strong message, it was also not either irrevocable or bloody. And to that extent, I think it represented, in Rabin's view at least, a sort of a middle reaction between doing nothing and doing too much.
My guest is Zev Chaifetz, associate editor of the Israeli news magazine Jerusalem Report. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us and speaking with Zev Chaifetz, the associate editor of Jerusalem Report, and he's speaking to us from Jerusalem. Has the deportations been controversial in Israel? Is there any opposition to it?
Well, you know, it's really quite astonishing. The day after the deportations, the largest paper here, Yediot Achronot, took a public opinion poll that showed that 91% of Israelis favored the deportation. And as you know, in a country like this, where everything is controversial, everything is debated, everything is a matter for contention, 91% is almost unprecedented. Then a week later, after the media blitz abroad on the poor Palestinians on the hill and the Muslim fundamentalists wishing everyone a Merry Christmas and all the rest of that stuff, they did another poll here, and it showed that still 91% of the public supported the action, including the very left-wing and dovish parties, which are a part of the Rabin government. And so to the extent that anything could be said to have an overwhelming consensus in this country where consensus is very rare, these deportations have got one.
How do you account for that almost unanimity in Israel, where, as you point out, there's always loud disagreement about policy decisions?
Well, it's pretty simple in a way. I mean, the Hamas people, I know they're sort of customarily referred to as the Palestinians or as Palestinian fundamentalists or something of the sort, but they really talk like Nazis. I mean, they talk about destroying the state of Israel and killing as many Jews as they can. You know, we have the tendency not to like the way that sounds. And we like it even less because it had been happening. Six Israelis had been killed by these fundamentalists just in the days that preceded the deportation. So that there was a sense here, I think, among many Israelis, among most Israelis, not just the right wing and not just the hardliners and not just the hawks, but also the doves, that we are talking about, not about a Palestinian group which wants peace with Israel or is in a disagreement with us over how much territory we should have and how much they should have, but a group which, as one Palestinian put it the other day, views this as a fight to the death with Israel. And if it's a fight to the death with Israel by people who are armed, it's not too surprising to discover that most Israelis would rather win it than lose it. And therefore, there isn't a great deal of sympathy for these terrorists.
The question of due process has come up. Do you think Israel should have held some kind of trials beforehand, before deporting the people who they did?
Well, I suppose that, you know, this is the one area where many Israelis felt uncomfortable because there was an appearance in the way it was done that the government tried to sneak it past the Supreme Court. And they were caught at the last minute. In the event, there was a Supreme Court decision, so there was some element of judicial intervention here. On the other hand, speaking for myself, since the Hamas people have declared war on Israel, I think that it's, you know, sort of sensible to imagine that they realize that in a war, they're going to be treated like enemy soldiers. And just as in a war, when you capture enemy soldiers, you don't normally have a trial for each one before you put them in a prisoner of war camp. In this case, at least in my view, especially since they're not Israeli citizens and have no pretension to being Israeli citizens, due process, while it would have been pleasant, is probably not necessary.
What kind of long-term impact do you think the deportations will have on the Middle East peace process?
Well, there are two possibilities. What we're hoping is that this will have a positive effect on the process because it will strengthen the PLO. Now, that sounds like a sort of a strange thing to say because Israel has been so adamantly opposed to the PLO for so long. But the country is just beginning to come around to the idea that the PLO and the PLO surrogates who are on the negotiating team are really, let's call them the lesser evil here. They're people who actually have, even if reluctantly, come to the conclusion that there ought to be a peace agreement with Israel between us and the Palestinians. And therefore, there is a feeling here that it would be a good thing to strengthen them. And of course, Hamas, which is the organization whose activists were expelled, is the great rival of the PLO. The rival of the PLO in terms of actions in the field and also for the hearts and minds of the Palestinian masses. Now, experts here usually estimate that perhaps 30% of Palestinians support Hamas and perhaps the remaining 70% support the PLO line. And one of the things that this expulsion was supposed to accomplish was to weaken the Hamas support and to strengthen the PLO. It may be, in the short term, that the opposite has occurred, that people have felt sympathetic to Hamas and that its support has risen. But I have a feeling that after the dust clears on this, people are going to look at it and perhaps come to the conclusion that the Hamas approach, that is to say, the destruction of Israel or nothing, which has been the Palestinian approach for decades and which didn't really get them any place, is so self-destructive that that it may win some additional support for the more moderate or pragmatic PLO point of view. And if that happens, it will be very good for the peace process.
Do you think the peace talks will continue next week?
Well, I don't know. I mean, what we do know is that the Arab foreign ministers have called for the continuation of the peace talks. So it's likely to assume that the Syrians and the Lebanese, which of course are the Syrians' puppets, and the Jordanians will turn up. The Palestinians seem to be of two minds about it, and they may, in fact, not come to the first session. But I'm very confident that if they don't come to the first session, they'll come to the second or the third, because what's being negotiated is so important to them, and for them to boycott the negotiations would be so counterproductive from their point of view that it would take an extremely irrational decision on their part to keep them away from the peace talks.
Is this going to be another CNN night for you?
Yeah, looks like it. It looks like it. We're from my porch, you can stand here and see where the missiles came over the last time. So we've got a group of friends here who are all foreign correspondents. We're all waiting to see if they're going to be sent to Iraq tomorrow. And we're waiting to see what CNN says and what flies over the porch.
Zev Chaifetz is associate editor of the magazine Jerusalem Report. He spoke with us earlier today from Jerusalem. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the airstrikes in Iraq?
Well, we'll have a report from NPR's Ann Garrels about what's happened today. So far, we've heard announcements from the U.S. and from some of the allies that there were airstrikes today against the south of Iraq. We'll also be talking with the woman involved in the Iraqi opposition. She runs the Iraq Foundation in Washington, D.C., about why opponents of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime have not been able to overthrow him in the past couple of years. And we'll have a story from Seattle, Washington, about a male nurse assistant who tattooed on his forearm HIV positive. The hospital says he'd better cover up the tattoo or he may not be able to return to work.
Thank you, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last week, the cable network called E! Entertainment Television began showing nightly reruns of a series that hasn't been seen on TV since it was canceled in 1969, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. TV critic David Bianculli was hooked on the show then, and it seems he's addicted all over again.
It's the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. With guest stars Mickey Rooney, The Who, Matt Paulson, and special guest star Betty Davis.
Look, the last thing I needed was one more hour of mandatory television viewing a night, but I can't help myself. Every night I watch these reruns of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and I see something amazing. Sometimes it's something I've remembered ever since I saw it back then, like The Who setting off that explosion at the end of My Generation. Other times, it's something I've long forgotten, like that subliminal American time capsule film that covered 150 years of American history in three very quick minutes. And sometimes, watching it is like a therapy session. After watching John Hartford on last night's show, for example, I finally realized why and where I picked up this weird habit of playing my face. And John Hartford was only one of the uniquely talented writers and performers on the Smothers Brothers show. The group included Steve Martin, Rob Reiner, Mason Williams, and Super Dave Bob Einstein, who back then was known as Officer Judy. All of them, at the time, were under 30. Yet despite the show's problems with network censorship and its controversial cancellation, it actually inferred a lot more than it came out and said. In 1967, when the show premiered and caught on fast, you couldn't become a hit by alienating the over 30 side of the generation gap. The secret of the Smothers Brothers was that they tiptoed on the edge and somehow satisfied both sides. So you had Jim Morrison and the Doors, backed by Nelson Riddle and his orchestra. You had a comedy routine by a young Bob Newhart, followed by several eye-opening numbers featuring the West Coast cast of the rock musical Hair. And, every so often, you had a visit from one of the central figures of the 60s, as in this show from November 1968.
Tommy also has a special guest, too, and he'd like to introduce him right now, wouldn't
That's
he?
Right, I have a beetle.
Yeah, but it's not the kind of beetle you would expect it to be.
It's the kind of beetle that you, I think you hoped it would be. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Harrison. Do you have something important?
Something very important to say on American television.
You know, we don't have opportunity of saying anything important because it's American television. Every time you say something, they try to say something important, they
cue the lines. Well, whether you can say it or not, keep trying to say it.
That's what's important.
You get that? Yeah.
And in that same show, the effort was evident, provided by musical guest Dion singing his new song.
Anybody here? Did you see my old friend Bobby? Can you tell me where he's gone from? You know, I thought I saw him walking up over the hill with Abraham and Martin and John.
To anybody who survived the 60s or is curious about them, these Smothers Brothers shows are required viewing, and they're made even better by the new interview bits before and after each show. Tom and Dick, as well as everyone from Steve Martin to Mason Williams, offer their memories of each particular program. I interviewed the brothers back in the late 70s, and Tom said then that he wouldn't allow the shows to be repeated because they didn't hold up. They weren't as full of controversy as everybody remembered them. But the brothers were fighting political correctness back in the 60s. And that fight in the 90s is as timely as ever. All 71 of the original shows are being presented by E! Entertainment, and getting to watch them after all these years is a classical guess.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistants from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
America bombed Iraq, sent troops into Somalia, and has been contemplating action in the former Yugoslavia. How is the military changing internally to meet new foreign policy demands? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with a military expert at the Center for Defense Information. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up in just a moment.